Again, topic for tonight is driving to shul on Shabbos. So, in 1950, the Rabbinical Assembly's Committee on Jewish Law and Standards issued several opinions about the legitimacy of vehicular transportation to synagogue services on Shabbos. What's interesting is that it was in 1950 that they gave this answer, despite the fact that the question had been in the air. It was already raised in 1932 to Boaz Cohen with the old Committee on Jewish Law, which had been a lowercase c, conservative, traditional type of committee that wasn't going to give answers contrary to the traditional law. And Cohen basically said, there's nothing we can do about it. There's no wiggle room. There's no way to relax the law on the ban on vehicular transportation on the Sabbath, even for a good cause.
The people that were asking the question obviously cared.
Well, the question is, why do people care enough to ask? And who's doing the asking? Is it the lay person or is it a rabbi? And for whom are they asking? For themselves or for others? And are those others already doing what it is that's being asked, or are they doing nothing and waiting to hear a response and going to act in as a result of the response?
The Orthodox schools,
yeah.
People drove there.
But the rabbis weren't asking questions to their higher-ups about what the legitimacy of such things.
Somebody asked the rabbi, and he would have said no.
Okay, well, that's a good policy, maybe. Now, in 1949, a committee was established, a subcommittee on the Sabbath was established, and they came to the conclusion that there is a halachic principle, mutav shiyehushogin v'al yehu mezidim. Better people should do something that's wrong and it be considered something bishogeg, inadvertent, than they do something that is wrong and it be a willful transgression. So that's a slogan that appears a few times in the Gemara, not that many times, and it is taken to mean that sometimes ignorance is not so much bliss as it is better than knowledge and spiteful defiance of the law. So, the implication of this principle, according to the subcommittee, was that there is no spiritual gain that can be derived from indoctrination of the people in a sense of guilt, which is a hopeless ever to transmute into feelings of teshuvah. In other words, don't make the people feel guilty, because having the people feel guilty is not going to accomplish some positive end. It will not result in teshuvah. That is the assumption of certain of the progressive rabbis in the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. Don't make the people feel guilty. Well, on the premise that people do feel guilty for an outright transgression, then the only solution is to make it not a transgression, which means to provide a liberal answer that's not based upon the traditional sources, but is based upon something else. And what is that something else?
Expediency.
Expediency, but how do you put that into words on a paper? Well, they'll try. It doesn't always come across as so impressive. Intellectually, it's not always so coherent, but they have to try.
That sounds like a thought on the platform 2-3 weeks ago. Uh-huh. When you give a warning to somebody, are they going to change?
Or are they not going to change?
It? No, resent it.
And have ill will towards the person giving... Means? Yeah.
What's that saying that you don't make a takana to the tzibur is not
able to... And goes in gzera la tzibur alem kim roba tzibur yichol la'amod ba.
Right.
Okay.
Is that for you?
Well, no, because this is not a gzera. This is a law of the Torah. It's not a rabbinic enactment that's being imposed. It's a law of the Torah that's being done away with. So they continue. We can't expect a return to to Shabbos by merely upholding Orthodox law as we have for 50 years. The paralysis of the Orthodox leadership for 150 years, combined with a steady decline in observance, means that now we need an accelerated rate of change. We make takanot, communal standards, takanot being something other than the strict halacha. It is an enactment, it is a change that is in the better interest, the perceived better interests of the community. Okay, so with that in mind, in 1950 you have a liberal opinion and two more traditional opinions. The liberal opinion was written by three rabbis. Morris Adler, who we've mentioned several times, was assassinated in 1966, was a rabbi in Michigan, and was the chairman of the committee at that time. Jacob Agus, whose name has come up in the past as well. Jacob Agus was an Orthodox rabbi by training. He was a musmach of Ritz, a Talmud Muvak of Moshe Soloveitchik, graduate of Yeshiva College and Ritz, and was one of the leading students in 1930s Yeshiva College and Ritz. But in 1945, 10 years after being ordained, jumped ship and joined the Rabbinical Assembly and openly acknowledged his association with the conservative movement. That was a very rare thing, by the way. Yeah. Irving Agus, yeah. So,
but at that time, the conservative movement was very close. It wasn't split.
So, what was rare about Agus's move was not that he went from Yeshiva College to the conservative movement. Plenty of people went from Yeshiva College to JTS. What was odd was that he went from Yeshiva College to Ritz and an honor level student at Ritz, and then an Orthodox pulpit, and a few years of a career as an Orthodox rabbi, and then has an intellectual metamorphosis and openly joins the conservative movement, not because of Parnassa reasons, not like the hundreds of others who, for reasons of livelihood, found a conservative synagogue and just moved in that direction slowly but surely. No, he had an open declaration of departure from Orthodox doctrine. He wrote books. He wrote several very impressive books. I don't think the war was the issue. He moved away from literal belief in revelation. So he went on his own route.
And
yes, you could say that. Now, the third rabbi was Theodore Friedman, and he later would come to regret having written this responsum. Theodore Friedman. So the question was posed by someone who needed advice as to the theoretical and practical aspects of Sabbath observance in America, which is quite different from Europe, and that the people are not abiding by the traditional strictures of the Sabbath. What can we do to revitalize Sabbath observance? Answer: a Sabbathless Judaism is no Judaism at all. That's a very critical point, because there are many mitzvot in the Torah. Who's to say that Shabbos is the most important? I mean, if you were to follow the strict criteria of the Talmud, you have three cardinal sins, which are the most important. And then you have other mitzvot that theoretically are capital crimes, and Shabbos is one of them. And others which are Chayav Kares, and others Chayav Malkus. There's a ranking of the mitzvot according to the tradition, and Shabbos is very high up on that list. But what they're saying here is that in America, if you don't sustain Shabbos observance in some manner, you can rest assured that the lay people will disappear as Jews. They're not going to be able to sustain their religious and ethnic identity without some kind of Shabbos observance.
That seems to be, you need a ritual.
Yes, and fairly consistent ritual, not just high holidays. So they go on to say,
even today you talk about someone who says,
right, it means something.
Yeah.
So, we believe that, quote, the modern Jews have the capacity for spiritual living and Jewish loyalty. So the assumption is that Judaism is not a lost cause, but rather that even among those American Jews who have slid down the path away from tradition, they can be brought back, but by what means? So, Sabbath observers, they said, are today in the fringe minority. Some numbers said it was 95% were not so-called Shomer Shabbos in the conservative congregations of that time. And they go on to say,
what year is that?
1950. Our congregants are like Tino Kshenishba Ben Hagoyim, like a baby that was taken captive by the heathens. It's a Talmudic expression, Tino Kshenishba. We apply that term to a Jew who doesn't know much about their ancestral heritage, and so they violate all the rules, not out of spite or malice, simply because they don't know. So here the conservative rabbis, the leading conservative rabbis, are speaking of their congregants in very low terms. He's a Tino Kshenishba. You say that about someone who knows nothing. And they're saying that about the bulk of their congregants.
What were they going to say, right?
I don't know, but it's not such a nice thing to think about. So,
why? They were like that also.
So not all of them. Some we'll
some
see.
Are,
well, some we'll see the criticism that this is all about the rabbis and not about the lay people. Yeah. So
this is about the lay people or the
rabbis? We're going to have to address that. It's unclear. Some people accuse this all of being about the rabbis looking for leniencies for themselves. So once people start working on Shabbos, they think that it is hypocritical to positively observe Shabbos in other ways, so that eventually Shabbos disappears. That's what the what Agus Friedman and Adler think, that if you have to violate the sanctity of the day in one respect, typically because you've got to go to work and make a living, and the boss won't give you off Saturday, then once you've crossed the Rubicon, so to speak, you're going to disregard the Shabbos in all respects. Now, is that really true?
No.
No. Okay, so it's typically not true among those who wanted to observe the Shabbos, but for reasons of basic livelihood had to go to work. However, among the children of such people, often it was the case that Shabbos ceased to be relevant in their lives, because once there are no longer any rules about what you can or cannot do, well, then you can do anything. Okay. And if you can do anything, you will do anything, including entertainment, which is not in the spirit of the Shabbos.
Idea of that era, how many Jews fell off the wagon and disappeared?
So the answer is
30%.
The answer is that the vast bulk of American Jews had some degree of synagogue affiliation in the 1950s. It was a high watermark for synagogue affiliation.
Wow.
Why? For reasons that are not entirely clear, but the sentiment in America was that you had to belong to a house of worship, whatever faith you were. Jew, Christian, doesn't matter. But synagogue affiliation did not mean a return to traditional observance and piety. Far from it. It just meant you paid dues and went every so often. And that was it. So although people went to synagogue occasionally, very occasionally, and they were members, they were not abiding by the strictures of the Sabbath. But that's exactly why the rabbis have this problem. Here you have conservative rabbis who now have under their thumb, or so they think, the vast bulk of American Jewry, who are not Orthodox, who are not Reform, who are affiliated now with conservative synagogues. So now the conservative rabbis have a great responsibility on their hands. So many Jews who aren't frum, far from it, are under their auspices. What do we do about it? So they're coming. If they're going to come to synagogue, it's going to have to be by vehicle. What can we tell them that it's okay, or can we not tell them that it's okay?
But
that's where this question comes up.
Anything,
huh?
If they come in the Orthodox shul, the rabbi, if he doesn't say anything,
yeah. Okay, so the conservative rabbinate is different from the Orthodox rabbinate in that the conservative rabbinate doesn't want to have this a cognitive dissonance. They don't want to have to ignore something, to pretend it doesn't exist. Their whole purpose of their denomination is to bring together, in not perfect harmony, but some harmonious relationship, the reality of American Jewish life and the tradition as it is evolving. Whereas the Orthodox are not interested in that. The Orthodox are interested in keeping the mitzvahs as they were.
Yeah, but if people went to a Hashkama minyan and went into the subway,
the rabbi didn't say anything.
And there was plenty of that. And there were people that also, I heard, brought their kids to shul, made sure their kids came to shul every Shabbos.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they got in the car and drove to the park.
Yeah.
You know, in the afternoon.
Right.
So there was a lot of that, but nobody said that the Orthodox rabbi jumped on them and said, "Yeah."
So the conservative rabbis are not criticizing the Orthodox rabbis for being critical of the laity. They're just
the
Orthodox rabbis are not saying anything.
Yeah, right.
The conservative rabbis, though, feel that they need to make a stand on this issue. Why? So some of them felt it was wrong that they should have kept their mouths shut. Yeah. However, a significant majority of them wanted some permissive ruling. Now, how permissive? They'd fight over it for the next 15 years. What are the parameters of that leniency? Let's continue. So, the program for revitalization of the Sabbath does not only include a leniency about driving to shul. It has a positive performative component that unfortunately got lost, and no one remembers this part. And what is that? The ultimate goal was the cessation of all gainful employment on Shabbos. However, interim steps included the lighting of candles on Friday night, Kiddush, Zmiros, all preparations done in advance, a beautifully set table, public worship at least once on the Shabbos, whether at night or in the day, some time spent on the study of sacred literature, no shopping or household work or rigorous exercise, and time devoted to spiritual recreation. Now, all that's very well and good. You can have all that and still do malacha on Shabbos. In other words, it's possible to be a machalel Shabbos in the technical sense, but have all those positive things the mitzvot say. You could be a zachor but not a shamor. That's effectively what the rabbis are saying as an interim step we must hope for. Now, even that was a bit of a stretch, a dream, a fantasy, because how many people in their synagogues on a week-in, week-out basis on Shabbos were coming to shul at least once, spending time davening, making kiddush, candles, zmiris, the benching, all the performative rituals, only a small percentage of the Jewish public was even doing that.
So, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Today,
yeah.
Jewish women, what percentage like candles Friday night? I heard that
was... I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Wasn't Friday night always big for the conservatives? They all
so in some synagogues, Friday night was bigger than Shabbos morning because they borrowed from what had been a reform practice early in the century to have the major Friday night service be later in the evening, the 8 o'clock service. That continued into the 1960s and 70s, although it eventually fizzled out. What killed the late Friday night service was actually... not television, that could do it too, but bar mitzvahs on Shabbos morning, because people only have tolerance to go to shul once per Shabbos. And if there's a bar mitzvah in the morning, and a kid is going to read Haftorah, and it's a large synagogue with a significant membership where there's a bar mitzvah almost every week, so when are you going to go? Are you going to go Friday night, or are you going to go Saturday morning? Likely you're going to go Saturday morning, if you can, if there's no work or recreation interfering.
And if you're invited.
And if there's a kiddush, right. Okay.
So you have to go a certain number of weeks before the bar mitzvah.
They had made a halacha about that, a takanas, chazal, yeah. So, now, driving is not a Sabbath activity, but driving to shul, they regarded as not being a violation. While it is true that one could theoretically daven at home, in fact, nobody does. That's their argument. And quote, "In our time, regular attendance at the synagogue has become a sine qua non for the maintenance of Judaism." Meaning, if you go to Talmudic Judaism and try to find the big gedilla about going to shul Shabbos morning, you're not going to find it. It's not in the Gemara, it's not in the Mishnah, it's not in the Shulchan Aruch, that the Shabbos morning services are somehow the be-all and end-all of Judaism. Yet, in 20th century America, it was. You're not going to sustain religion if you don't go to shul regularly on Saturday morning. So, and nobody's davening at home. They might not even know how to daven at home. They might not know how to read Hebrew. So you have to be in the house of worship Saturday morning, and you have to get there somehow. And how you get there, now it's okay, no matter how you get there. So, so suburban life meant driving pretty much everywhere. Even short distances, but all the more so long distances if you're in a distant suburb, not right in the immediate surroundings of the urban environment.
Did conservative schools have Minyanim in the morning or not?
A lot of them did. Yeah. Almost all of them did.
They did.
Now, they quote the Talmudic dictum, "Tafasta meruba lo tafasta." If you ask for too much from these people, you're going to get nothing. So therefore, we're going to ask for positive observance of rituals, and we're going to ignore, or now allow, at least b'diavad, certain violations of the rules in order to accommodate the positive observance of Shabbos in the synagogue.
Not for themselves, though. I mean, you know.
So we're going to see some rabbis drive to shul. So they also allow the use of electric lights for Oneg Shabbat. That sort of purposeless flipping on and off of lights, they didn't say was okay. But if you need to turn on the lights for Oneg Shabbos, that's fine.
But that's understandable, because the concept on Shabbos of having candles was with Shalom Bayis.
Yeah.
And you had in different rooms.
Yeah. So, in a different response, Arthur Newlander ruled that electricity is not fire, and therefore electricity is not forbidden by Torah law, and so for things that are otherwise permitted, you can use electricity. But for things that are otherwise forbidden, you can't use the electricity. And therefore what?
Can't drive.
Well, driving would be a problem, but watching TV, you're just watching a screen. It's otherwise permitted, other than the fact that you have to turn it on. So that becomes okay. The radio also okay.
So the Shabbos clock was good then?
They weren't worried about clocks. They were turning on and off. Okay. Now, the waste electricity. So the
only it works on.
I remember how they do it.
Non-consistent
yeah.
laws throws everything out.
Yes, yeah, so the, those who opposed it, including Ben Zion Boxer, will make that very point. Opposed the leniency about driving. Yes, Boxer, absolutely. We're going to see soon. Forest Hills Jewish Center, where my grandmother was his secretary. Okay, yes, my grandmother's there.
He was a firm guy.
He was one of the more from the conservative rabbis, yes.
He wrote something on Jews and Christians. Or whatever.
He wrote a bunch of books. He was a big scholar. Now, many... Agus and Friedman and Adler continue to throw in the kitchen sink. Basically, any excuse they can come up with to justify this leniency, they're going to put in their response. Another thing they mention is Ein Shavut Ba Mikdash. There is no rabbinical decree prohibiting things in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. That Torah law applies in the temple, but all the rabbinic safeguards are ignored, and we allow the sacrificial cult to continue, only inhibited by whatever the Torah prevents. So, it was that very same line. So, early reform in Germany argued that the temple, the synagogue, the modern-day synagogue / temple, is a mikdash ma'at, like the Beit HaMikdash of old, and therefore you could use an organ in the synagogue, because why can't you use an organ on Shabbos? Only by rabbinical decree of clay shear, of musical instruments. But by Torah law, there's no ban on musical instruments on Shabbos. So, ancient with the mikdash, use the organ. And the temple, the synagogue, equals the modern-day Beit HaMikdash. That's their argument. That's for a reformer in the 1840s, that makes sense. They're not looking for the restoration of Zion, and they're opposed to Shivat Zion. So they could say that the synagogue is the temple. But for a conservative rabbi to use that line of reasoning in 1950 has a certain unpleasant flavor, because it means that there's no more Beit HaMikdash. This is the Beit HaMikdash. All right, it's a bit of a problem. Now, they also say certain laws became obsolete over the years. Like what? Like Chal of Yisrael and Chadash. Now, is Chal of Yisrael and Chadash obsolete? Go to the Vada of the Five Towns. They'll tell you it's not obsolete. All right? Every pizza store has Chal of Yisrael and Yashan.
But Rabbi Feinstein said that we do have Chal of Yisrael because it's
supervised by the government. Okay, but so the point of Agus and Adler here is just to say that certain aspects of Judaism are basically ignored by everyone, even the holy rollers. Nobody does certain things anymore. So the fact that we're abrogating an element of Judaism, we're just going with the times. Certain things go away. All right.
Yeah, we can't say the holy rollers did away with it.
Well, maybe in 1950 it was hard to find anybody who was observing it. Or at least they couldn't find anyone. They didn't look. So therefore, it is permissible for the enhancements of Shabbos enjoyment and for easing discomfort and performing a mitzvah to use electric lights and to drive to the synagogue. However, they made clear that this only applied to driving to your synagogue when the distance is unwalkable. But what's the problem with the idea of an unwalkable distance? Who's to say? Who's to say what's unwalkable? So let's now turn to Robert Gordas. Robert Gordas, who was a rabbi not too far from here in Rockaway Park, okay, he objected to this leniency. And he said, we shouldn't do legislation before we exhaust interpretation. That this leniency of Agus and Adler and Friedman was identified as a takana, as an amendment to halacha. Not as a legitimate interpretation of the old sources, but as a conscious break from the old sources. This is a new concept. That is, we're permitting something that really shouldn't be permitted for social reasons. And Gordas says, you shouldn't do that. It's a departure from the methods of jurisprudence of old. We should interpret with an eye towards leniency, granted, but we shouldn't be enacting legislation so easily.
But can't you say from 1932 to 1950,
things changed.
That avenue has already been...
We've tried it, and it hasn't taken us anywhere. Yeah. You're right. That's what the others would say.
Gordas may have done it
Gordas was a centrist, but he was a centrist who leaned towards traditional practice and towards not so traditional theology. Now, modern Jews have surrendered the concept of Jewish law in theory and in practice. That's what Gordas says. So he's souring on the attitudes of modern Jews. Quote, "To modify Jewish law in order to bring it into conformity with their way of life is tantamount to amending the Constitution of the United States so as to harmonize it with the viewpoint of an anarchist." So bear in mind, these quotes were not for public consumption. The teshuvot, the responsa that were written by the rabbinical assembly in this era, was basically confidential. Only the rabbis were supposed to know what was actually said in these meetings or what was written. Later on, the cat was out of the bag. You could buy the books in the library. You could find them in the library. You buy them on Amazon. But in the early years, this kind of unfavorable rhetoric towards the laity was not for public consumption.
But how can you blame these takanot, because they're right, the population was not responding? How can you blame them?
It's hard to blame them. It's hard to blame them. Okay.
Yeah. This was in the 1920s, early 30s. There were men in shul for mincha.
Yeah.
Davening mincha. And their wives were getting off the streetcars with bags of shopping.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So they were in the Orthodox shul.
Right.
They were there. Their wives were
doing something else. Yeah.
So I doubt the rabbi necessarily got up on the pulpit and say it's wrong to do this.
Some might have. Most probably didn't.
But on the other hand, the kids outside saw the woman getting up.
Yeah. Right. We're going to discuss Chabad in about 4 weeks from now. Yeah, Paul.
For a guy who grew up in one of these conservative cities, who had an Orthodox rabbi, who had the conservative gang, his name was Sturgeon, involved with the whole, conservative movement, understand the concept that in 1932, people still lived in Brooklyn.
Right, and they didn't need to use their car.
They're moving to another town.
Yeah.
They're moving out, and you live far from shul.
Yes.
For 40 minutes. Wow. Nobody else did. 40 minutes for the long walk.
Yeah, sure.
So when you talk about, you're talking about a time when it's very different,
yeah,
and the places are very different, and the people who are in this room probably didn't have parents who lived in that type of suburbia. You lived in Muncie or you lived somewhere else. But these were long distances.
Sure. It's true. It's true. Okay. It's a fair point, and now I want to show you what Boxer had to say, and he's aware of that reality, but he wants to flip it around. So just finish with Gordas. Gordas says there is a slogan in the Talmud, Puk chazei mai amadabar. What does that mean? Go out and see what the people are saying, what the people are doing. And when you have a halakha which is ill-defined or uncertain, it hasn't been ruled upon definitively, we go to see popular practice, and that will inform the ultimate decision of the decisors, the halakhic decisors. So he says, that's all well and good when the vast bulk of the Jewish public is traditional in their practice, and they want to abide by the rules, and so whatever they do is roughly corresponding to the rules. But it doesn't hold true in 1950s America, when the average Jew is indifferent to the Jewish law, and so we can't look to their practice, popular practice, as a factor in determining the official policy. Okay, so instead he says, what should we do? What should the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards do? Forget about the Shabbos law. Leave the Shabbos law alone. The people will do whatever they're going to do, irrespective of our statements. Instead, we should focus on marriage law and synagogue practice, meaning the liturgy, the egalitarian issue, which will be a big issue in the decades to follow, and the issues, the aguna laws, the marriage laws, the divorce laws, areas where the rabbis really can control what happens. Remember, you need a rabbi to get married. I mean, you don't, but in America you do. You need a rabbi to get divorced religiously. You need a rabbi to allow a woman to get an aliyah because the rabbi's in charge of the shul. But the rabbi's not in charge of your private Shabbos observance. So therefore, leave that alone and focus on the areas where the rabbis really have a fiefdom. That is a strong point. Okay, now we go to Boxer. So Boxer said, there are many people who are otherwise observant of the Sabbath law who drive to shul. This is the exact opposite of what I said 15 minutes ago in the name of the subcommittee from the year earlier. The others said, once you violate one aspect of Shabbos, it's all a slippery slope downhill, you're gonna lose it all. Boxer said that's wrong. There are plenty of people who take their religion very seriously, but because of the distance, and it's too far to walk, at least maybe they feel they can't do it every Shabbos, they're going to drive. But in every other respect, they're going to treat the Shabbos as a holy day and adhere to the rules.
So would they make sure they live closer to Shabbos?
Ah, okay, so they should, and Ismar Shorsh will criticize them for not, but the reality is they didn't all live so close to the shul. So there is much demand to change the travel law, so says Boxer, but it involves more than just turning on a car. It also involves handling money and muktzah items and various other aspects of Shabbos desecration. So therefore, if you allow vehicular transport to shul, what you're really doing is saying there no longer is the minutia of Hilchos Shabbos, because a lot of details go into driving a car that are contrary to the law, and if we're just going to ignore them for convenience sake, then all the books on the shelf that are Hilchos this, Hilchos Borer, Hilchos Muksa, Hilchos this, Erevin, forget about it. None of that matters anymore. We're just disregarding all of that. It's not a simple issue of the car. There are many, many details of the Shabbos law that we would have to just ignore. And he says that's an impossibility, or it's wrong to suggest it. This is Boxer. Yeah. So then he says,
I'm curious to know, I remember not that many years ago when we had a no cash fair on Shabbos or Sunday weekends.
Yeah.
If you remember, there was a brief one had near the Yom Ha'Aron or the Goyim,
uh-huh,
to enhance people to go shopping.
Right.
There's no charm.
Okay, so that's going to play a role.
There was a very big controversy whether an Orthodox Jew could do it. They said for sure not the bus, because the bus sometimes would have to make only a stop.
Right, but the subway was maybe okay.
Stops and goes. Yeah.
Okay, so that's going to be an issue here.
So we have the Shabbos bus concept.
Yeah, the Shabbos. Yeah. So he says like this: man needs a periodic emancipation from machines. So this is not a halachic argument. This is a philosophical argument, a moral argument. We're in a technological age, and you know what? We need one day in seven where we are divorced from our technological devices. Now, he's saying that in 1950. Halachas kama v'kama, in 2018, we need to divorce ourselves from electronic devices for one day in seven.
Norman Mailer was ridiculed because he had said the same thing,
uh-huh,
when he was running for mayor of New York. Once a month.
Yeah.
Nothing, because of pollution.
Right.
And because of the general usage of power, fossil fuels.
It's a good point. So
he didn't win.
I know. So if he says like this, people should live close to shul. And many people, they drive for convenience, but they walk on the high holidays when they feel emotionally that they must. In other words, you live a mile and a half away, you don't want to walk every Shabbos. But Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you can walk a mile and a half. Which goes to show you, there is no objective standards of what's too far, or what's beyond a reasonable distance to walk. You'll do the Mesiris Nefesh when you feel religion pulling at your heart. Like on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Okay. So he says, we can tolerate driving to shul as better than a total denial of Shabbos worship. However, it shouldn't be that the rabbis declare it permissible. It should be that the rabbis ignore the topic and that there are no objective standards. This is Boxer. So Boxer is saying, we're making a mistake in issuing a ruling which is permissive. We should recognize that people are going to do something, and they'll make their own standards as they go along, but it won't be our doing. It'll be their doing.
You don't want to give it an imprimatur afterwards.
Right. Then he says like this, guilt is a good thing. The problem is not the sense of guilt. The problem is the violation of the law. And that guilt can bring people back into the fold when they feel enough of it that they realize, I have to change my way. So whereas the other rabbis said, no, guilt is a terrible thing. We want to make people feel less guilty. There's too much Jewish guilt around. If we say it's okay, then their conscience will be clean. Boxer says, no, we shouldn't be doing that for them. If they feel guilty, good. It means they still care about the halakha. They still care about the Torah. When they don't feel guilty anymore, we know all is lost. They couldn't care less. So let's hold on to the guilt factor.
But it doesn't matter. Because if you're more permissive, you take away the guilt, the next generation won't follow it. And if you don't say anything about it at all, and you drive even though it's not condoned by the rabbi, the next generation will do it anyway.
Listen, it's not easy to sustain Judaism. It's as simple as that.
Okay. Now, very tricky, you know?
From the door of our door to out the door. That's my slogan.
It's nice, but it's hard.
So now, Arthur Neulander, who later would be the chairman of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, he issued the ruling on electricity. So whereas Agus and Adler and Friedman wrote about driving, Neulander wrote about electricity. He said it's not fire, whether halakhically or scientifically. And he says the machmirim would not be able to open a window in their house because it would affect the thermostat. Life would be unbearable without a refrigerator. And he says the Orthodox allow the refrigerator. Rav Meisha allowed the refrigerator, so we're allowing a little bit more. He says we ignore the Pesik Reisha de lo nichale or de nichale and focus on Ein Tzricha Legufa. We can allow telephones. And he says Rabbi Simcha Levi of the RCA allowed microphones in shul. That's true. Simcha Levi was the head of the RCA Halacha Commission before of Soloveitchik in the late 40s. And he issued a lenient ruling about microphones so long as it was not touched. It was turned on before Shabbos and just was there and you didn't speak directly into it, but it caught your voice.
It's common in Baltimore.
It was common in my shul in New Rochelle in the days of my predecessor's predecessor. It was done away with, this leniency, when Rav Soloveitchik became the head of the Vad HaHalacha in the early 50s. But this is being written in 1950 when Levi was still in charge and suitably Orthodox rabbis are allowing the microphone. So, and then he says, Chaimson allowed the elevator in a building. Who's Chaimson? Moses Chaimson was Orach Chaim, the rabbi, was the professor of codes, Shulchan Aruch at JTS, and allowed you to take an elevator on Shabbos.
Am I including pushing the button?
So I don't think he allowed pushing the button. I think he just allowed you going into the elevator.
In those days, they probably only had elevator operators.
They had with the doorman, with the operator. In Manhattan, you should know, I heard the name of Rabbi Lookstein, that above the sixth floor is Lamala Min HaTeva, above nature. So if you take the elevator only if you're above the sixth floor, but below that you have to walk. That's interesting because his brother is a friend of mine, and I walked with him 40 flights of stairs one time to the Bikkur Cholim on a Yontif.
By that time, the guy died.
No, he didn't. Okay. Freudless. So, okay. There's a discussion about the various opinions. And in this discussion, you have a very angry comment. Well, really, a saddened figure making a desperate plea to avert disaster. This is Samuel Rosenblatt. Now, Samuel Rosenblatt was the rabbi of Beth Tefillah in Baltimore, was the son of Yossele Rosenblatt, and was one of the most frum of all the conservative rabbis, because he really wasn't a conservative rabbi.
He was a classics professor at Hopkins.
Correct, yes. He was a big scholar of the classics, and he was the best friend of Boaz Cohen, who was the professor of codes and Talmud at JTS. And they were classmates, class of 1925 at the seminary. And Rosenblatt was a very traditional Jew and traditional rabbi. It was always a borderline Orthodox shul. And so he says the following: I've been part of the rabbinical assembly since I graduated 25 years ago. I am loyal to my alma mater, and I thought there was room for me in the rabbinical assembly, but now I realize that a great change has happened. People think that conservative Judaism allows one to be Mechal Shabbos and eat treif, and now I see that it's true. He says that in front of everybody else, all of his colleagues. People say that it stands for Chilul Shabbos and eating treif, and now I know it's true. So he says, don't publish this leniency. People on the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards should first have to pledge allegiance to Jewish law. So he's calling out these members of the committee, saying, you guys are traitors to traditional Judaism. Now, that didn't go over well. William Greenfeld, who was one of the leading liberals, took exception to Rosenblatt's questioning of the right of the committee members to serve. But he said, you're right, we have a revolution. We issued a takana, which means we have authority to do these sorts of things. And nothing is going to hold us back anymore. So Greenfeld admits this is a revolutionary act, but we don't feel guilty about it. We think we're doing the right thing. And if you, Rosenblatt, have a problem with it, that's your problem. So what does Rosenblatt do?
In the end, it was a slippery slope. People did keep going off of other things like shopping and going to the mall.
Yeah, yeah, it's, no doubt. No doubt. Okay, so Rosenblatt then writes a letter to his colleagues a year later. No, he wasn't on the committee, actually. He was just a member of the Rabbinical Assembly who was so outraged by what happened that he threatened to resign his membership. So he says, there has recently been a tendency to modify Jewish law using factors that are outside the realm of Jewish law itself. Logical consequences, the undermining of halakha, which was a basic principle of the seminary when it was founded. We believe that a majority of the Rabbinical Assembly still believe in interpreting Jewish law by its own canons. A group of Rabbinical Assembly members have called into being an association for the reaffirmation of authority of rabbinic law. So, this is the first time, but not the last time, that there'll be like a rump organization within the Rabbinical Assembly that is so outraged by a liberal ruling that they create not so much a breakaway as a faction within the organization, hoping against hope that their faction will be able to turn the tide of the broader movement back towards traditional observance.
Years later with,
so with the women's issue, and it would happen with Halivni, a Union for Traditional Judaism, was a breakaway in the 1980s as a result of ordination of women. We're going to spend a whole week on that ordination of women and the breakaway in a few weeks. So this is a predecessor of that, where someone is just so infuriated by what their colleagues are doing that they can't take it. And ultimately, Rosenblatt resigns his membership and it does not want to participate further in the conservative movement because it's not for him anymore.
But if everybody thought...
The shul eventually became an Orthodox shul.
If everybody thought the way Rosenblatt thought,
yeah,
that means there would be no concept of conservative Judaism because they would be following Allah.
There aren't anyway.
Yeah, but not many people follow him, and not only
very, very few were rightists within the Rabbinical Assembly who were willing to buck the trend and fight back, or for that matter, leave the organization because of its liberalism. For the most part, what happened, rabbis who were centrists went along with the movement so that the center went from being over here to being over here. The rabbis don't sustain their positions throughout their careers, but rather their own positions evolve together with everybody else.
But he was an older man at
that time. He was in his 50s at that point. Okay. In those years, that was old. By the standard of the Rabbinical Assembly, that was fairly old.
But
most of the rabbis were younger than him.
But he was so traditional, yeah.
Right.
How did he graduate Ohio?
Well, there was no yeshiva college in those years. He was born in 1901.
Oh.
So in those years, people went to the seminary for a traditional ordination. Okay. Now, Isaac Klein. So Isaac Klein, who was probably one of the most religious of the conservative rabbis, rabbi in Buffalo, was Springfield, Massachusetts, and then in Buffalo, New York, he said that the Agus Adler Teshuva will do nothing but spread irreligion. So that's a harsh statement. It's going to spread irreligion. People will drive to the movies. That's a direct quote. Then he says, quote, the main question I have is whether the rabbi wants the heter for himself. And he wasn't wrong, because plenty of rabbis did drive. So,
when we flew the plane 2 weeks ago.
You should know there's a lot of unpleasantness on the internet in reaction to Aaron Pankin's death.
My question was, why wasn't he leading this congregation?
He's not a congregational rabbi.
Okay.
So Rabbi Jack Cohen, who was a real left winger, he said that the heterim, the leniencies, are not as important as bringing positive religion to the people. Don't focus on the leniency. Focus on the revitalization of the Sabbath. Quote, we are not providing halakha for the rabbis. Many of us, even on the left, incidentally, will still continue to walk to shul whenever possible. So in that sentence, you see a few things. One, that the left-wing rabbis don't necessarily abandon traditional observance just because they're left-wing rabbis who are looking for leniencies for the general public. However, he's willing to acknowledge that there are some who do. And whenever possible means, I'll try to be a traditional Jew, But if circumstances don't allow me to be a traditional Jew in this or that respect, I'm going to personally take advantage of the leniencies that we're offering to the laity. And many rabbis eventually did the same thing. Today, how many rabbis in their own homes, among their wives and children, are what we might call Shomer Shabbos, broadly speaking, without the watching of TV or the like? Very, very few. Very, very few. Yes, from my own personal experience, I know that there are not that many conservative rabbis left who are, roughly speaking, Shomer Shabbos.
You're talking about rabbis who were really right-wing reform. That's in reality.
Yeah. Okay. But that wasn't necessarily true in the 50s. I'm talking about now 2018. Okay. Now, Ismar Shorsh's father, Rabbi Shorsh. Now, Ismar Shorsh was the chancellor of JTS from 1986 to 2006. Is a great scholar of modern Jewish history, whose area of expertise was German Jewish history, and is a very traditional Jew in his own right, and davens at Ramat Ora, an Orthodox shul sometimes. So his father was a graduate of Breslau, and they came to America after Kristallnacht in 1939. And his father was a congregational rabbi, and a traditional one at that.
Which
I don't know which synagogue. But he was very traditional by the standards of the RA, and he said, on the question of driving to shul, we should not be acting unilaterally. We should defer on this question to the big gedolim of the land of Israel. And anyway, those who don't observe won't listen to us, and those who don't observe are already driving. So, quote, why should we play ball with this insincerity? Why should we play ball with this insincerity? He's acknowledging that no one is going to exclusively drive to shul and never drive anywhere else because no one really follows the rabbis. They do whatever they're going to do. So we need not be in the business of catering to their whim. All right. Mordechai Waxman, who was one of the great conservative rabbis of all time, the rabbi of Temple of Israel of Great Neck, was a centrist. But when I say he was a centrist, I mean, like I said a few minutes ago, the center moves. The center moves. So the center moves to the left. It never moves to the right. As the decades go on, he's going to allow more and more things. So let's see what Waxman had to say. Now, Waxman wrote the book called Tradition and Change. Tradition and Change was the slogan of conservative Judaism in the 1950s. And it's a nice slogan, Tradition and Change. But how much tradition and how much change? Well, the argument in 1950 was we've had too much tradition and not enough change. So let's now tip the balance in favor of change. So he says like this. For 50 years, we have been a movement. You cannot distinguish in terms of ideology from the Reform or the Orthodox movements. Men in our movement have made changes individually. We have not made changes as a movement. We have not asserted the principles of a movement. In point of fact, we're not a movement. We are static. I should like to see the assertion that change is possible within the RA, good, bad, or indifferent. Now, that's a horrible thing to say.
Change at any cost.
Yes. And why? Only to prove the point that conservative Judaism actually exists. That it's not moderate orthodoxy or traditional reform, but that it's a standalone movement that has its own identity. That's very important to Waxman. And it was important to a bunch of the centrist rabbis. But that means you come up with decisions that on the surface, and even beneath the surface, are not good decisions. But you do it just to assert your own identity that's different from this guy and that guy. That was Waxman's point of view, and it really was not a very good one or a very healthy one. Okay. So
he was also married to a very progressive woman.
That's right, yeah.
Could be.
Now, his father was a very frum guy. Mayer Waxman was a major scholar who taught at Reitz at one point, or rather TI, and was a leader in the Mizrahi. But his son moved in a certain direction. So in 1961, the Sabbath responsum was reconsidered because people wanted to know, can I drive to something other than shul? Can I drive for Bikur Cholim? Can I drive for a bar mitzvah two towns over? Can I drive to a wedding? Can I drive to a funeral? Can I drive to whatever it is?
Shabbos wedding.
Who knows? You never know. Okay? You never know. It's Tisha B'Av weddings too. So, can I drive to something other than my most immediate synagogue, nearby synagogue? So, Theodore Friedman, who was one of the original writers of the Responsum, said that he opposed extending the leniency. He opposes it. Not even for bar mitzvahs or visiting the sick. No. No extension of the leniency. And he also acknowledged that the law is primarily for rabbis. That the lay people are going to do whatever they want, but the rabbis who might live far from their own shul are driving to their own shul for their parnasa on Shabbos. Then the question was, what about when the conservative movement sponsors a gathering? The United Synagogue Youth, USY, has a kinnus. They're getting together from the whole region, from many different synagogues, and they're gathering in one town. So, can the children be taken on a bus for a conservative movement function on Shabbos that may be at a synagogue, maybe not at a synagogue, but even if it is at a synagogue, can you do this? Can you take 50 kids and put them on a bus on Shabbos? And so the answer that they gave was no answer at all. In other words, if you're doing it, we're not going to tell you that it's wrong. And if you're not doing it, then nobody should try to impose it upon you. In other words, tradition should be allowed to stand if the local rabbi opposes it. If the local rabbi says, I don't want 50 kids getting on a bus to go to my USY convention in my shul, then don't do it. Don't offend the traditionalist. But if your local rabbi is okay with it, then who are we to say it's wrong? Now that's a big problem, because from that you have in the later decades, and I remember this as a kid, bar mitzvahs, where there's the service on Shabbos morning in the synagogue, and then there's the party on Shabbos afternoon at another location, and the bus is waiting just outside the parking lot to pick up all the kids to take them to the disco. And some of those kids might have been from families that were traditional in nature and really would not have wanted to have their kid go on a bus on Shabbos with all the other children. But once the movement is allowing something, who is the individual parent to say that it's wrong? It's a bit. This is not a slippery slope. This is a you fall off the cliff. Okay.
No, but the thing is, there's no standardization.
Right. There is no standardization. Yeah. Michael Higger, who was a traditionalist, Rabbi Michael Higger was a professor at the seminary, and he was a traditionalist, but he offered every now and then a wacky liberal ruling. So he said that you could have a bus take people to the synagogue so long as the driver was a non-Jew, it didn't cost any money, and the synagogue's name appeared on the side of the bus. Yes. To indicate that this is being done with the sanction of the shul because it's being done the right way, not the wrong way. I don't know. I don't know anything about it. Okay. Okay. Now, what about the parking lot? So, can the parking lot be open? Well, this question was posed to the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, and for the most part, they said, well, we don't want the synagogue to be too actively involved in the parking of the car, so there shouldn't be a valet, and there shouldn't be movement of the chains up or down in front of the lot. If it's going to be open, let people just drive in themselves, turn their car off, and walk into the shul, but not make a big deal about it. Other places wanted to keep the lot closed, even if they recognized that people were driving. Now, in the Orthodox shuls, that was always the case, but in some conservative shuls, they put the chain up in front. Okay, so, in 1960, the question was posed by the president of the East Nassau Jewish Center whether or not the lot can be open on Shabbos. Now, the East Nassau Jewish Center... East Meadow Jewish Center. East Meadow Jewish Center. My mistake. East Meadow Jewish Center. And the rabbi was Rabbi Israel Noble. Okay? Now, Rabbi Noble was a graduate of Yeshiva College and Reed's class of 1940. And I remember him. He was an old traditional Jew. Rabbi at a conservative synagogue. His grandson is my best friend. So...
they live in Merrick?
They live in Merrick, yeah. So... his daughter lives in Merrick. Debbie. So they asked the question, can you keep the lot open on Shabbos? But it was a weird thing because the president of the shul was asking against and behind the back of the rabbi. And they said, our rabbi is not a member of the rabbinical assembly. He's a member of the RCA. And he won't allow it. He's a real holy roller. He won't allow it. But what do you say? Can we open the parking lot on Shabbos? We like your opinion so we can undermine our own rabbi.
They went to another organization.
Well, they were members. The synagogue was a member of the United Synagogue. So they were turning to the rabbinical assembly, which made sense. But the rabbi of that shul was not affiliated with that group. So the answer was, we don't give responsa to people who are not our members. But moreover, you need to listen to the Mora D'Aspra, your local rabbi. So therefore, if he says the lot is closed, the lot is closed. Now go away. In other words, they didn't really want to answer the question because it's not their. They didn't want to tread on somebody else's domain. But the answer is you got to listen to your rabbi, and so the lot remained closed. Okay. In 2004, would that happen today? I don't know. The RA today is not in the habit of answering questions to specific people about specific circumstances. Instead, no, they don't. They write responsa that are general in nature for policy and for advancing of scholarship. They're not responding to a specific question of Chaim Yankel and giving him a direct answer. They give a broad policy answer for the movement. Okay, so in 2004. An article was written in the magazine Conservative Judaism, the quarterly publication. And the article was written by Avraham Hain. It was titled Reflections on the Driving Teshuvah. So it's written 54 years after the fact. What does he have to say? That some argued that the driving teshuvah did not have the desired effect, whereas others claimed it helped build new communities. Now, I think it had no effect on building new communities. The communities existed. And people were going to drive no matter what. So what was the effect? Maybe a handful of people who were felt guilty and felt less guilty. But what the authors of the Teshuvah recognized was that the Shabbat revitalization was a complete failure. There never was a turnaround within the conservative ranks of people becoming more devoted to the mitzvot aseh, the performative aspects of Shabbos. That never happened. So those who went to Camp Ramah and those who were heavily involved in USY might have sustained that which was in their family already. But it was almost never the case that someone who had nothing from family background became a pious observer of the commandments by dint of USY or even Ramah.
There were no Bali Tshuva in that movement.
Well, there were people who eventually found their way to the Orthodox synagogue, but it usually was because they came from a family that had the background. Okay, so the Teshuvah was written in a bygone era when the conservative rabbis believed that the rabbinate as an institution had almost limitless power to enact legislation on behalf of the community. Something that by the 2000s the conservative rabbis no longer believe. They're more devoted to the sources, and sometimes the manipulation of the sources beyond credulity, but the sources, as opposed to enacting something that's not based upon the ancient literature. Now, in around the same time, David Golinkin, who is the head of the conservative halakha committee in Israel, and is a very, very big-time Talmud Chacham, a big scholar, he was asked a question by someone who lived in Petah Tikva. Can I drive to shul on Shabbos? There's no Masorti conservative synagogue in Petah Tikva. The closest one is either Ramat Aviv or Hod HaSharon, which is, you know, 5, 6, 7 miles away. So can I drive to shul on Shabbos? And what did Golinkin say? He said the rabbis in 1950 were dealing with Jews who were not near a synagogue, whereas you in Israel, in Petah Tikva, you're near plenty of synagogues. They might be Orthodox, you might not like them, but they're synagogues. The Jew in 1950s America couldn't read Hebrew and couldn't daven on his own. Whereas you in Israel can read Hebrew and you can daven on your own. So all the factors that might have led to a liberal ruling a half a century earlier are not in place in Israel among, you know, moderately observant Jews. So rather, swallow your pride and go to the synagogue down the block that happens to have a mechitza. So Golinkin says, even though we don't believe a mechitza is necessary, a mechitza is not forbidden. So go to the Orthodox shul. You should know that in America today, there are rabbis, including in my neighborhood, who believe it's forbidden to go to an Orthodox shul. That the mechitza makes it taboo. Really? And they will not go to an Orthodox shul under any circumstance.
Conservative rabbi.
Conservative rabbi, yes.
Was
yes.
A feminist
Yes. Okay.
So we feel the same way about going to conservative.
All right. I'm just acknowledging that this does exist. Okay. Now, David Fine had the following response. Everyone knows about the driving teshuva, yet nobody ever reads it. Not even at JTS. There's a fear that there's some sort of a heresy involved in this responsum, and so nobody wants to delve too deeply into it. But, and he says, I don't drive, personally. He, the rabbi, doesn't drive. But the responsum is still valid for those who want to take advantage of it. And people who care about halakha, even if they don't comply, they know that driving is only permissible to shul. So all this talk about people are going to go to the movies and the shopping, but they know they're not supposed to. They know it's only for shul. That's what he claims. I don't know. Then we go to Castle Abelson, who was for the longest time the head of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards in the 1990s and early 2000s. And he said, the driving responsum was the most important thing that led to the conservative movement as it is today. If you want to know what is conservative Judaism, it means driving to shul on Shabbos. That's what it means. This is the most important responsum they ever sent out, more than the Aguna, more than the second day of Yom Tov, which we'll talk about next week, more than the egalitarian. This is the one. And they faced a tough choice. They could either maintain the traditional halakha and give up the synagogue as a focal point, or they could allow Chilul Shabbos. And what did they do? They allowed Chilul Shabbos. That's what Abelson says. And he's not saying in hindsight that it was bad. He's saying we had to keep the synagogue as the main focus of our Judaism, because the home was not a very Jewish place. If the home had been a very Jewish place, like it was in Brooklyn or the Bronx, then you wouldn't need the shul. But in Levittown, where the home wasn't so Jewish, you needed the shul. And we can't give up on the synagogue, therefore people have to get to the synagogue. That's his argument. Now we go to the last one for tonight, Ismar Shorsh, former chancellor of JTS. And he says that the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards continue to defy public opinion on the retention of Zionist passages in the prayer book, on Hebrew language in prayer, on the absolute need for circumcision, on the need for a gittin for divorce. In many ways, conservative Judaism kept things that the public wasn't really interested in. And yet, they chose to strain credulity to allow for writing on Shabbos, despite the fact that there was no groundswell of a demand that they act on this issue. So what is he saying, Shorsh? They didn't need to do this. The people didn't like Gittin, they didn't like Mila, they didn't like this, but we kept all that stuff. So people drive to shul on Shabbos, we should have kept Shabbos too. And failure to maintain standards on Shabbos meant that the conservative movement gave up on the value of dense Jewish settlement. Where do you have dense Jewish settlement?
Where you can't walk.
Right here. I mean, in Woodmere, okay? Where you see lots of people on the sidewalk walking to shul Shabbos, or where you see people walking in the middle of the street and they offend the drivers because they're arrogantly walking right down the middle of the road, like was the case in Beechwood, Ohio, and you had Jew versus Jew, or as we sometimes used to have in Great Neck, I remember. So failure to maintain the value of dense Jewish settlement where you could walk to shul meant that people are spreading out geographically. And what do you not have? You don't really have a community. You have people getting together at the synagogue for an hour or two for prayer services, but you don't have a real community, a kehila. You just have a bunch of stragglers who walk into the shul at 10:30. And that's what Shorsh believes was the biggest failure of the movement. Okay? And he says, to fall short is an insufficient reason to abrogate. To fall short is an insufficient reason to abrogate. We leave the law as it is, and we try to attain it, and if we fall a little short, so be it. But we'll try again. Of course, he said that at the tail end of his career as the chancellor. While he was the chancellor, he had to toe the party line and not attack the decisions of the CJLS and the Rabbinical Assembly. But once he's a private citizen, basically, after his academic career is largely over, he was able to speak from the heart in a way that would have offended and did offend some of his disciples and underlings. But you know what? When you get to a certain age, you can say whatever you want. We'll stop here.